Listener, after diving deep into another true crime story, I've been loving a little wind-down ritual at the end of the night, and that's exactly why I'm obsessed with Mood. Mood is the online spot for federally legal, hemp-derived cannabis grown on small, pesticide-free family farms right here in the U.S. They ship gummies, flower, edibles, pre-rolls, and more discreetly, straight to your door. No lines, no hassle. They've got something for every vibe. Chill for sleep, focused for deep work, happy and euphoric when you just want to feel good, or even that extra spark for better sex. My go-to lately, their Sleepy Time Advanced Gummies. Super smooth, mind-soothing calm that kicks in fast and leaves me waking up clear. No grogginess. Perfect after a long day. And right now, first-time buyers get 20% off your entire order when you use my code Obscura at checkout. Head to mood.com, find the gummy, flower, or edible that matches your perfect mood, and save 20% off with code Obscura. Everything's backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee. Go to mood.com/obscura and try it today. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. So listener, May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and a good chance to check in with yourself. Some days feel fine, and other days you are lying awake at 2 a.m., running through every decision you have ever made. Lately for me, that has been work-related stuff. Just feeling a little stuck and not sure who to talk to about it without getting biased advice. And the truth is, no one has all the answers alone. That is where therapy comes in. With BetterHelp, you fill out a short questionnaire, and they match you with a fully licensed therapist. They have been doing this for over 12 years with more than 30,000 therapists on the platform and have served over 6 million people. And if your first match is not the right fit, you can switch anytime. You don't have to be on this journey alone. Find support and have someone with you in therapy. Sign up and get 10% off BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
Welcome, listener. I'm glad you're here. Take a seat next to the fire.
Welcome to Obscura, where we shine a light on the dark.
Bakersfield in the last week of July sits at the bottom of San Joaquin Valley with a kind of dry, accumulated heat that builds through the morning, holds through the afternoon, and refuses to lift through most of the night. By the middle of the day, the asphalt on Highway 99 throws shimmer up into the sky, and by evening, the air inside a parked car can put a person on their knees if they're not careful about which door they open first. The sun sets somewhere over the Templar Range, and the temperature drops, but only a little, and only for a while. Even at midnight, the foothills hold the day's warmth and give it back slowly into the dark. This is oil country. Pump jacks bow and rise in the fields east of town, and refinery towers blink red along the edges of the city. The sound of trucks on the 99 and 58 carries for blocks in the dry air. The neighborhoods between those highways settle into a particular kind of quiet at that hour. Stucco houses with low roof lines, concrete driveways, and front lawns that have given up some of their green to the heat. Streetlights cast shadows through the slats of chain-link fences. Every house looks like every other house, the way tract homes were built to look in this part of California in the 1980s. Loch Lomond Drive runs through one of those neighborhoods. The home in question stood at the corner where Loch Lomond meets Cleveland Way, a modest single-story house with a fence around the small backyard and a driveway long enough for a pickup truck. Vehicles and driveways like the one belonging to that family are a common sight in this part of Bakersfield. A gray Chevrolet pickup, the kind of truck the working class of the Central Valley has been driving for 40 years. The ordinariness of this house can't be overstated. It's something I like to mention in these episodes. People see movies and they expect houses like this to look like haunted houses. But It's never the case. And what happened on Loch Lomond Drive that night did not come from somewhere else. There was no broken window, no pried door, no tampered lock. The harm was already inside the house. It had been living there for a while. The man of the house was Ray Salvador Coriel. He was 29 years old. He worked steady hours, paid his bills, drove the gray pickup, and had been married twice. His first marriage, to a woman named Veronica, had begun in 1999 in Nevada. Ray and Veronica had known each other since they were 10 years old. Her aunt had lived next door to his family in an apartment complex when they were children, and the two of them had grown up alongside each other, married young, had two kids together, and divorced in 2004. After the divorce, the children stayed primarily with Ray, while Veronica continued to see them at least once a month. By the accounts of those who knew the two families, the relationship between Ray and Veronica was not adversarial. They spent holidays together with their respective extended families. They had shared an Easter only 1 month earlier. Veronica would later tell reporters that, as far as she knew, Ray had been a good father. That was the word she used, good. They had been childhood friends. They had grown up together. There was nothing in any version of him she had known that would have prepared her for what was about to happen. By 2011, Ray had remarried. His second wife, Sheila, lived with him in the house on Loch Lomond Drive, along with the two children from his first marriage and additional children from the second. The household was full. School schedules, lunches packed, laundry rotated through. The ordinary engine of a family that size. The 7-year-old girl at the heart of this story is Cassandra Coriel, Ray's daughter from his first marriage. By July of 2011, she was about to turn 8. There was a birthday on the calendar, and there were the small anticipations a child carries for that kind of milestone. There was an older brother in the same house, 11 years old that summer, who knew her habits the way only siblings know each other. The brother would later tell investigators something that has never quite settled in the years since. He said that the night before everything happened, his sister had told him she had a funny feeling. She had told him she felt like someone was going to take her. She said it the way children sometimes just say things, half in the language of fear and half in the language of imagination. And her older brother heard it and did what an older brother does. He let it pass. Children say strange things at bedtime. The night was hot, the house loud, with the hum of an air conditioner, and the lights eventually went off. Cassandra went to her bed in her own room, in her own bed, in a house surrounded by her family, and that should have been the end of it. By the early morning hours of Wednesday, July 27th, the house had gone through its usual shutdown. The lights were off, the dogs settled. The streetlights along Loch Lomond Drive cast their long, sodium-colored squares across the lawns. Inside, the family was asleep, and somewhere in the dark of that house, between the time the lights went out and the time the sun came up, a decision was made. At 3:45 in the morning, the house woke up, or at least somebody in it did. Sheila Coriel would later tell investigators that Ray had gotten up early to leave for work. Shortly after he left, she went to check on the children, and when she opened the door to Cassandra's bedroom, the bed was empty. The blanket was disturbed. The small bedroom looked the way a bedroom looks when a child has been removed from it without time to rearrange the sheets behind them. Sheila called 911.
911, what's the location of your emergency?
It's Bakersfield, California.
Okay, and do you need police or an ambulance?
I need the police, please.
Okay, what happened?
My daughter's missing.
Your daughter's missing?
She wasn't in her bed.
How old is she?
She's 8.
She's what?
She'll be 8 tomorrow. It's her birthday. Okay.
I know you're upset, but I need you to take a deep breath so I can understand you. You said she's 8?
Okay. So she's going to be 8 years old tomorrow. Her birthday's tomorrow. She's going to be 8.
July 28th?
Yes, ma'am. She'll be 8.
What year was she born?
2011, she's going to be 8, so 2004.
Okay. What color shirt and pants was she wearing?
Last night when she went to bed, she was wearing a pair of hot pink cheetah print pants, and she had on a little white pink shirt with a kitty on it.
Okay. Is she white, black, or Hispanic?
Huh?
Is she white, black, or Hispanic?
She's white. Well, she looks Hispanic, but she's white.
Okay.
She's got darker skin, brown eyes.
What's your name, ma'am?
My name's Sheila. I'm her stepmother. I just called her father. Freaking out right now. She lives with us.
Okay. Sheila, what's your last name?
My name's Coriel, too.
Okay. And you last saw her when she went to bed?
Well, I gave her a hug and a kiss last night.
Okay. What time did she go to bed?
She didn't go to bed until about 9:30 last night.
Okay. Have you yelled out for her in the house?
Yes, I've been screaming for the last 5 minutes.
Okay, I still can't understand you. What was that?
I've been screaming for her. About 2 nights ago, we had an incident where my husband came home and he smelled smoke. He came in the room and there was a straightener. My straightener for my hair was on her dresser and a towel wrapped in it. And it was smoking and the window was open. And me and my husband freaked out because we didn't know what was going on. I thought my daughter maybe got up and got the straightener, you know, playing with it or something, and didn't realize that it could do that. So we didn't really report it. So we were just like, oh, you know, maybe that's what happened. She was scared to tell us.
Okay. Where's your husband right now?
He's on his way back from work.
Okay.
And I know her mother's threatened me and ready to take her from us.
Okay, are any of the windows or doors open right now?
I don't see anything, and that's the thing, I bought alarms, so she couldn't leave.
Okay, and the alarm is armed right now?
No, they weren't alarmed, I would have heard them.
Okay, are there any other kids in the house?
There's 4 other children in the house. They're all here.
They're all there?
Yeah.
Okay. Have you yelled for her outside?
I did not. I just don't see why she'd go outside by herself. She's super scared of dark at night.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, the last 2 nights because of what happened, I made her sleep in my room with me. And she's not in here with me. I got up. My husband just left for work. I got up to see. Check the house. I always get up. I check the house, make sure all the doors are locked, windows are locked still, and I check on my children. I went in here in her room, and I noticed that her bed was kind of, you know, like her blanket wasn't as usually as poofy as it usually was. There was a dog in here. She's got like a full, you know, the big stuffed dog.
Does she know what the password is to the alarm?
There's no password.
But is there a code where she could disarm? Okay.
No, it's not a house alarm. It's just when the door, you know, the window or doors where the magnet gets pulled away, it goes off real loud.
Okay.
So, I don't know where she'd be. And I checked the bathroom. I looked everywhere for her.
Okay, how do you turn the alarm off and on? Is it always on and it just covers the windows?
No, you just turn it by a switch. All you have to do is turn on the switch up, and it sounds the alarm if the door is open or anything. It's kind of like a door chime.
Okay, and it's still on? It wasn't turned off?
When my husband left, he turns it off when he leaves.
He turns it off when he leaves?
Yeah, so when he goes out the door that the kids, you don't wake the kids up, and that's when I usually get up and I turn it back on.
So you turned it on as soon as he left?
Yes, ma'am. I got up, I turned it on, like I said. I checked the windows to make sure all the windows were locked. And I came in here, like I usually do, and because of the incident the other night, I turned the light on to check for my daughter, and I pulled the blanket back to see if she was all cuddled in her blankets because I couldn't see her head. And it was her dog. Her stuffed dog, and she's gone.
Her stuffed dog is gone, too?
No, it's just her, but her dog was there. Both her blankets are here.
Okay, is anything missing?
No, not that I can see.
Okay.
Her clothes are here.
The story she gave the dispatcher was straightforward. She had been asleep. Her husband had left for work. She had checked on the kids, and Cassandra was gone. There was no sign of forced entry. No broken window, no boot print on the back door. Just an empty bed in the interior room of a quiet house in central Bakersfield, with the rest of the children still asleep in their own rooms, and the porch light still glowing where it had been all night.
I don't see anything, I see nothing. Her clothes, her even her little coin purse, everything's here, her glasses.
Okay, so if someone were to go to her bedroom window and open it, the alarm would have sounded?
Yes, ma'am. At least she knew. And I know she came home and she said she was scared after she'd seen her mom. I asked her, baby, what's wrong? She said, my mommy told me she's going to take me away.
Okay. When did that happen?
Oh, man. It's been happening for the last... She's going into third grade, but she was in kindergarten when we took her away from her mother. We had to take her away from her mom because they were sending her to school dirty, and when she peed her pants, I guess they didn't change her. Her mom's a drug addict. I know for sure she's admitted to me and Ray, me and my husband. And she told us that she was on drugs, but I think she mentioned the word heroin. So me and Ray had took her away from her mom.
Okay, is there any other way somebody could have gotten in the house?
There's two windows in the room, but both of them look locked.
Okay.
There's a back door, but I don't see her going back there. We got some big dogs.
Okay, have you been in...
Okay. I just don't want to go outside because...
Ma'am, do you know the mother's address?
I don't know. She was homeless last time we knew.
You can find the
last
address.
That's another reason she was... The last address, my mother-in-law just went to it. I'm not too sure. It's down the street.
Okay, what's her name?
Her name...
Okay. How old is she?
Yeah, she... Veronica, I want to say she's 27 now. And she's got a... He's her fiance. His name's Mike. Do you know Mike's last name? No. Oh my God. My mother-in-law knows his last name.
Is your husband there now?
No, he's not. He should be pulling up any minute now.
Okay.
Cause he was almost all the way to work when I got it. By the time I checked, I got up and used the restroom. And like I said, I go through the house every day. And I just got up this morning and wanted to make sure she was in there because of what happened the other night.
Have you been through every single room in your house?
Yeah. Yes, I have. I've looked for her everywhere. I've looked in my bed. I thought maybe she crawled in my bed with me. She's not in there. I even woke up my 11-year-old son because I thought maybe she got scared and got in bed with him. It's her older brother. They have the same mom.
Okay.
And I know that his mom wouldn't take him because him and his mom don't get along. But that little girl, she told that little girl, I don't know, numerous times that they were going to take her from us. And she told me she was scared. And I told her, oh, mommy would never take you. She's just saying things because she's upset, you know? I thought maybe... She was just upset that we had took her from her and told her that she couldn't see her because of the drugs.
Okay. When was the last time the mother did see her?
Last time the mom seen you guys, my son's 8 weeks old. They seen her. She didn't even get to see him, actually. She came over 3 days after my baby was born, which was July 1st. It was about that weekend, so around July 6th, I want to say.
Okay.
She came over, and she didn't call us or anything. She just showed up, and she wanted to take the kids with her.
So about
she wanted
seven
just to
ago?
Take her daughter. Huh?
So it was about 7 weeks ago?
Yeah, it was about 7 weeks ago, but she told her...
Listener, let me tell you about Chime, because my younger self would have benefited from this. You know how traditional banks love to nickel and dime you? Overdraft fees, monthly fees, paying to use an ATM, just to get your own money. Chime isn't playing that game. No, it's fee-free banking that's built for you, not the 1%. Here's what you get. Up to $1,150 a year in rewards, 5% cash back on a category of your choice, like gas or groceries. Savings that grow with a 3.75% APY, which is 9 times higher than the national average. Premium travel perks like airport lounge access and a 24/7 travel concierge. They even have SpotMe, so you can overdraft up to $200 fee-free. And if you need cash now, MyPay lets you grab up to $500 of your paycheck early. That's why Chime was named America's number one choice for banking. Head to chime.com/obscura. That's chime.com/obscura. It only takes a few minutes to sign up.
Chime is a fintech, not a bank. Banking services for MyPay and Chime Card provided by Chime's bank partners. Optional products and services may have fees or charges. Stated annual percentage yield and cash back for Chime Prime only. No minimum balance required. Checking account ranking based on a J.D. Power survey published October 20, 2025. For more information on APY rates, MyPay, SpotMe, and travel perks, go to chime.com/disclosures.
Listener, how many supplements do you take that you actually know are working? Because for years, I was just buying whatever sounded good on the label and hoping for the best. That is exactly why I love True Diagnostic. It is an at-home health test that takes the guessing out of all of it. With one quick finger prick at home, True Diagnostic measures up to 180 biomarkers and analyzes over 1 million data points to tell you what your body actually needs right now. You get digital results back with a personalized 90-day action plan, 3 real recommendations to follow, and then you retest to see your progress. No generic advice, no influencer fads, just real data from advanced epigenetic testing that is trusted by top longevity clinics. Honestly, my younger self would have benefited from this. Right now, my listeners can get 20% off at truediagnostic.com using code Obscura20 at checkout. That's truediagnostic.com and use Obscura20 for 20% off today. Choose TrueAge, True Health, or the Combo Kit as a one-time purchase or subscription.
She came over, I distinctly remember, because of the fact that she wanted our kids, but she just wanted our daughter at first. And I looked at my husband and shook my head no, because I had a funny feeling. And he said, no, either you're going to take both of the kids and spend time with your son too, or you're not going to see them. And she's all, well, I'll take them both, I guess. And she was like real reluctant on to take my other one with her. And then my husband said, no, never mind, I don't want them going. Well, I had asked him before, after she left, why didn't you let the kids go? He said he just didn't want them going, that she seemed like she was acting odd, like she was on drugs again.
Okay, what's your husband's name?
Ray, R-A-Y.
And his same last name?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, and what kind of vehicle is he gonna be driving?
He's gonna be driving a 2010, I do believe it is. It's a dark gray silver Chevy, 4x4.
Okay,
four doors.
Should be home any minute?
He should be home any minute by now. I mean, my mother-in-law just took off. She's driving a Mitsubishi White Endeavor. She went to go see if she could find my daughter at her grandma's house, which is down the street.
Okay.
Which is the last known address for Veronica, too.
What was that address?
I'm not sure what the address is. It's on Brandage here. I mean, I've only been there. Yeah, I've only been here. I've been there a handful of times.
I mean, is your mother doing her way over to that address?
My mother-in-law is going over there to see if she can see is there. Because that's the only place I could think that they would take her, because they're homeless. The last time I knew, they had bought an RV, the one that you can drive. They bought one of those, and they told us they didn't have money to be putting it in.
Okay, Sheila, the deputies just arrived there. Can you go outside and talk to them?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Within an hour, the city was moving. Patrol cars rolled through the neighborhood. Officers knocked on doors. The description went out. 7-year-old girl, brown hair, last seen in the bed she was no longer in. A search of the surrounding blocks began. Helicopters were spun up. By the time the sun came over the Sierra Nevada and started baking the asphalt of Highway 99 again, half of Central Bakersfield was looking for a child who had vanished out of her own bedroom in the middle of the night, and nobody had any idea where she had gone. The man's name has not been preserved in most of public reporting, but the action that he took has. He was a gardener. He was working in East Bakersfield that morning. He was watering the lawn. He was holding a hose. He was, to all appearances, having an ordinary Wednesday morning at his job, a child walked up to him. She was small and dirty, with a black eye that was nearly swollen shut, and she was wearing the clothes she had gone to bed in. She was, by any measure that mattered, a child who should not have been where she was. East Bakersfield is not Central Bakersfield. They are not next door. They are 9 miles apart. And a 7-year-old girl does not, in the night, walk that distance on her own. The little girl asked him for water. He gave her the water. He took her gently to a neighbor's house. The neighbor called the police. Within minutes, the address on Eucalyptus Drive was its own kind of crisis scene, with a child found, a child being held, and a child whose name nobody on the property knew yet, but who matched exactly the description that had been broadcast across Kern County since just after sunrise. She had been asleep, she said. Then someone had taken her out of the house. She remembered being grabbed by the neck. She remembered being put under a couch, and the couch was in the back of a truck. And the truck, she said, was a gray Chevrolet pickup, similar if not identical to the family truck. She remembered drifting in and out of consciousness. She remembered waking up under the couch in a field. She remembered screaming and pushing the couch off her to get out from underneath it. She remembered standing up in the dirt and walking, looking for water, looking for help, looking for anyone. The injuries on her body told the rest of the story. Bruises and abrasions, a black eye nearly swollen shut, evidence of sexual assault, the kind of damage that does not happen during a fall or fight or an accident, the kind of damage that happens on purpose, by hand, by force. She was 7 years old. She had walked or been driven 9 miles and then deposited, possibly while still unconscious, in a dirt field on Eucalyptus Drive, with a couch left over her like a shroud. The Kern County Sheriff, Donnie Youngblood, will later tell reporters at a press conference that she had been left for dead. He said it plainly in front of the cameras, in a careful, flat voice that spoke of quiet anger. The girl had been sexually abused and left for dead in a dirt lot. There is no softening that sentence. By mid-morning on Wednesday, July 27th, Cassandra was in protective custody. She was alive and conscious, and she was being seen by doctors and by detectives. Gently, the way a child of that age is seen, with social workers in the room and care taken about every word, the story she gave, in pieces, over hours, was the story of being taken from a bed she trusted by a person whose face she could not name in the dark. When investigators asked her whether she was afraid of getting someone in trouble by talking to them, she said something that has stayed in the case file ever since. She said her stepmom would never do that to her. She said that if it had been somebody else, yes, she would get them in trouble. She did not name her father. She did not, in that interview, accuse anyone. She simply ruled out one woman in her family. Sheriff Youngblood held a press conference that day. He gave a few details and held back the rest. The investigation was active. The girl was safe. The investigators were following leads. Over the next 24 hours, the leads they were following would all begin to point in one direction. Listener, I want you to keep a couple pieces in your hand for the section that comes next. The first piece. There were no signs of first entry at the family's home. No broken window. No pried door. No tampered lock. Whoever had taken Cassandra out of her bedroom had walked into that house through a door that was not locked against them, and had walked her out of it the same way. The second piece. The truck Cassandra described, the gray Chevrolet pickup with a couch in the back of it, matched the family's own truck. It matched her father's truck. The third piece, the one that is going to do the heaviest lifting in a moment, is this. Ray Coryell, that morning, after his daughter had gone missing, had been called by his wife. His wife had told him their child was gone. Ray had not, at the scene, behaved like a parent in crisis. According to investigators who were watching him, he was, in their words, acting as if everything was fine. He did not ask deputies for updates on his daughter. He did not press them. He did not pace. He stood in his own house, the house his daughter had vanished from, and gave the impression of a man whose Wednesday was proceeding on schedule. By the end of Wednesday, the question of what had happened was no longer the question. The question was, who? And by the end of Wednesday, the people who were trying to answer that question were already looking at the man whose truck matched the description of the truck the child had been put inside. He was asked voluntarily to sit for a polygraph examination. He agreed. He came in that same week. He was asked questions about his daughter, questions about the night, and questions specifically about whether he had had sexual contact with her. The polygraph examiner, in the report that was later released, indicated that on the questions related to that act, Ray Coryell showed a high probability of deception. He was not arrested that day. The polygraph alone is not a basis for arrest. The polygraph is a tool, and investigators use it to find seams in a story. The places where the body tells a thing the mouth refuses. They had a seam now. They needed something underneath it. A second polygraph was scheduled for the following day, set at noon on Thursday. Ray was told to come in. He did not come in. A crime scene is a document. So is a phone. A record made up of small electronic handshakes that any modern device performs every few minutes with the closest piece of infrastructure that can hear it. In 2011, most of us were already carrying a tracking device in our pockets and not thinking of it that way. The phone in the pocket whispered to a tower. The tower wrote a record. The record, in cases like this one, became the difference between a story and a verdict. By Thursday morning, July 28th, detectives at the Kern County Sheriff's Office had asked for and received the cell phone records associated with Ray Coryell's number for the early hours of the previous day. They drew a line on a map. The line they drew was not the line of a man going to work. Ray had told his wife and told investigators that he had left the house at 3:45 in the morning to drive to his job. His job, listener, was not in East Bakersfield. His job was in the opposite direction. The cell phone records placed his device in East Bakersfield. They placed it specifically in the area near the field on Eucalyptus Drive. They placed it in the area where his daughter, hours later, would walk up to a gardener and ask for water. They placed it in the area where a couch had been dropped in a dirt lot with a child underneath it. The line on the map did not match the line of a commute. It matched the line of a kidnapping. Listener, this is the moment in the case where the room turns. Up to this point, Ray Coryell was a father whose daughter had been taken, and the investigators around him were treating him with the quiet gravity that a man in that position is owed. They were watching, but they were watching softly. They were taking notes, and they were waiting. The cell phone records ended these niceties. Thursday at noon, Ray was due at the sheriff's office for that second polygraph. He did not arrive. Instead, he texted his wife. The texts were not the texts of a man going to a meeting. They were the texts of a man going somewhere else. He told her he wanted to harm himself. He told her he deserved to die. In one of those messages, he made a disclosure he had not made to her before. He told her he had been the victim of a sexual assault by his older cousin when he was a child. He sent these messages from inside the house. He had locked himself in his bedroom, and the bedroom contained, among other things, several shotguns. His wife called for help. Deputies arrived, surrounded the property, and what followed was a seven-hour standoff. SWAT officers, negotiators, vehicles staged at the perimeter, family members brought to the curb to talk to him through the line. The neighborhood in central Bakersfield, the one that had been waking up the day before to a missing child, was now waking up to a SWAT vehicle parked at the corner of Loch Lomond and Cleveland Way, and a man with a shotgun inside the house. While the standoff played out, law officers stood on the lawn with their weapons trained on the front door. Detectives elsewhere in the county were closing the gap. The cell records had landed, the girl's account, the truck description. By the time the sun was sinking over the Temblor Range that Thursday, the district attorney's office had what they needed for an arrest warrant. The warrant was signed. It charged Ray Coryell with kidnapping to commit rape, and sexual intercourse with a child under the age of 10, with attempted murder. While the warrant was being signed, Ray, inside his bedroom, was writing. He was writing letters. He addressed one of them to God. The first words of that letter, according to the court documents that would later make their way through the public record, were, "Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned." He wrote letters to each of his children. The letters told them he missed them. He wrote them as if he was already gone. Around 7 in the evening, after 7 hours of negotiation, Ray came out of the house. He was taken into custody, transported to the sheriff's headquarters, booked, and held on a bail set at $1 million. In the interview that followed, he gave a statement that hung over this case. He did not, in any clear way, deny what happened. He told investigators that he had blackouts. He said he had a flashback that night, a flashback to his own childhood abuse while standing at his daughter's bedroom door. He said the next thing he remembered was being out in a field. He said he could not recall how Cassandra had ended up in his truck. He said, and these are his words from the court documents, "I think I heard a cough." He said he remembered hearing a voice. He said he remembered nudging a couch and tossing a couch pillow. He said his wife had called him while he was in that field, and the call had pulled him back into the moment, and he had looked around, and he had not, until that instant, understood where he was. On its face, that is a strange story, but it's not the account of a man who knows what he did, but the account of a man who knows what was done and who is hiding from the truth, from underneath a layer of language that lets him not own it. The investigators in that room were not in the business of letting that language do its work. He was charged, originally with 11 felonies. The list included kidnapping to commit rape, kidnapping a child under 14 for lewd or lascivious acts, sexual intercourse with a child under 10, and attempted murder. If he had been convicted on all 11 counts at trial, he would have faced multiple life sentences without the possibility of parole. There would have been no number on the back end of his prison time. He would have died inside. The case sat, and years passed, for almost 4 years. During those 4 years, Cassandra grew up. She lived with her mother and continued to recover in the slow and uneven way that survivors of that kind of harm recover. In June of 2015, Ray Coryell, now 33 years old, took a plea. He pleaded no contest to three of the original charges, two sex crime charges and the attempted murder charge. The plea took the multiple life sentences off the table and also took a trial off the table. It took the possibility of Cassandra needing to take the witness stand and tell her story to a jury in a room with the man who had raped her. The sentence happened the next month, in July of 2015, almost exactly 4 years after the night of the kidnapping. The judge handed down a sentence of 34 years to life in a California state prison. 34 years to life is not the same sentence as life without parole. It carries a back end. It says on paper that there is a day in the future where Ray Coryell will become eligible to be considered for release. That day is decades from the day he walked into prison. It will come up. When it does, parole boards will weigh what was done in that house on Loch Lomond Drive in the early morning of July 27th, 2011, against whatever Ray Coryell has become in the intervening years. People in Cassandra's family will, presumably, attend those hearings in front of strangers in suits every few years till a man dies inside or comes out. Listener, that is where the legal record sits. But the legal record is not the whole story. The whole record includes the bedroom door he stood at and the moment he chose to open it. It includes the 7-year-old girl who told her brother the night before that she had a funny feeling. It includes the gardener who put the hose down and gave a thirsty child a drink of water. It includes the wife who got the text from her husband saying he deserved to die and was correct.